What is up? We are back, Tony in the Field.
Tony in the Field. Oh my God, I love those guys.
So excited to be on Tony in the Field. Love the show.
Oh man, I can't wait. I'm fired. Preston, what's on the menu, brother?
The gloves are coming off.
James catches, puts up a three. Won't go. Rebound, Box. Back out to Allen. History pointer. Bang! Tie game with 5 seconds remaining.
Swoops. Dancing for the win! Texas is back, folks!
Indiana's 9 out of 12.
Oh! Gerald Green! That's a man's jam!
Hey, what's up, you guys? This is Tony in the Field coming to you on the evening of Wednesday, October 21st. Coming up on today's pod with Big Tony and myself, the Field, we have Aaron Fentress of the Oregonian joining us. It was a really great interview with Fentress. He will talk all things Ducks, both past and present. Gets into the Taggart era, the Bilotti era, the Chip era, and then he gives his thoughts on the current crystal ball era. Plus, folks, you know we had to do it. We had to ask Fentress about Gary Anderson, and we did just that. Fentress gives us some great reaction with his take on the Gary Anderson era in Corvallis, and in particular, how it ended. Plus, we'll ask him a bit about the Portland Trailblazers and his thoughts on the current state of the industry. Beyond that, after that interview, we have our college football observations. Big Tony has an Ed Orgeron rant. We'll talk two at a time, John Wall, and I'll give you my college football gambling locks for this upcoming weekend. So that'll be the podcast coming up. Up first, it is our interview with Aaron Fentress. All right, folks, joining us now is a man who has been in the industry for multiple decades covering the Ducks, Beavers, Blazers for the Oregonian. He's just a fantastic writer, and if you're a fan of any of these local teams, as the majority of our audience is, I'm sure you guys have read him over the years, no doubt, and maybe even gotten into it with him on Twitter, because he likes to go back and forth with some folks on Twitter. How you been, Fentress? Thanks for coming on.
I'm doing great, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. How long have you been covering the Ducks?
My first season was 04, but then I had a few seasons with the NFL sprinkled in. So I would say full-time 11 or 12 years, and then full-time part-time 15 or 16. And this year I'm not fully on the Ducks. I'm covering the Blazers now for the Oregonian, but I'm helping with the Ducks as well, especially with, you know, the Blazers season being pushed out to maybe January, I think. So, but yeah, for the better part of the last 16 years, I've been covering them.
Who's been the best team that you've seen over the years? Was it that Mariota Heisman team?
Yeah, I think the 2014 team is the greatest ever. I remember actually when I was at NBC Sports Northwest, we did a roundtable debate about that between me, Harrington, Bilotti, Campbell, and Pelham were there. We were all talking about the greatest team.
Nice.
And I was like, it's 2014 because you won a playoff game. It happened to be the Rose Bowl. You won the Heisman. You won the conference. And you beat a team that was on like a 25-game win streak or something like that. They were defending national champions in Florida State, and they had the reigning Heisman winner. Well, Mario had already won it before that game. And I'm like, that's the biggest win Oregon's ever had. And then Bilotti actually disagreed with me because he said it's how you end the season because they ended it with a loss. And so he pointed to his 0-1 team because they ended it with a win over Colorado. And I'm like, wait a minute. Beating Colorado in Fiesta Bowl is not a bigger deal than going to the national title game in 2010 and 2014. So we went back and forth on that. But, yes, I think without a doubt that's the greatest team ever. Plus, they had three number one picks on that roster, Mariota, Armstead, and Buckner. And then you had Grossi was a third rounder. You had Fisher, who was a second rounder. And Ifo would have been a first or second rounder. So that was a pretty loaded team.
Did Joey Harrington jump in there and say, yeah, man, the 0-1 team?
I don't remember what Joey said about that, to be honest with you. I think he might have taken Bilotti's side, but they were both wrong.
Who's been the best soundbite over the years?
The best soundbite in terms of?
Yeah, like a player or coach.
A player. Gotcha. I always loved talking to Arian Springs. You never knew what he was going to say. He was fun. Who else was good? Man, I'd have to think about that. Recently, you know, Troy Dye. I mean, Troy Dye is another level. because he'll just say anything. Of course, Cliff Harris was just precious because that guy, you know, he just always has something cocky to say, bulletin board material. Those are, you know, just off the top of my head, those are the three of the best.
And Fentress, what about coaches? Who delivered the best coaching soundbite, whether that was, you know, X's and O's or just a funny response to a question? What do you remember from the coaches at Oregon?
Mike Bellotti so far, Mike Bellotti by far was the best, still is the best Oregon coach to interview because he enjoys talking about his team. He enjoys just talking. I'll never forget. Listen to this story real quick. So remember when Masoli got in trouble for the laptop thing? I think this was the press conference when he got kicked off the team, or I can't remember, but something around Masoli. And so Chip Kelly held a press conference because this is when Bellotti was the AD. And Chip Kelly was like, we're not going to talk about it was something he refused to talk about. I can't remember what it was exactly, but Bellotti was in the room. And then someone asked Bellotti a question. He wasn't up at the podium. He was just standing there. And Bellotti said, well, I'm not here to talk or do interviews. I'm just here to support Chip. But then he kind of answered that question. And then someone gave him a follow-up. And he answered that question. And then he gave him another follow-up. And next you know, everyone moved over to the corner of the room where Bellotti was and just ignored Chip and started a press conference with Bellotti right there because he couldn't help himself to start talking. So by far, Bellotti. I have to say this, though. Chip was the most interesting because you never knew what kind of nonsense he was going to put out there. Like, oh, we don't care about the USC game. It's no different than Nevada. You know, that kind of thing. Or he might give some kind of snarky comment back to a reporter who asked a legitimate question. So he was more amusing, but Bellotti was by far the best.
I like that. I like John Neal, too. I especially that year when I was covering him for KVAL when Oregon went 4-8. And that was the Helfrich year when he got booted, obviously, and there's a lot of controversy around that season. John Neal had some just money sound bites during that season.
Assistant-wise, John Neal is definitely good.
Yeah. That was kind of a crazy season there, 4-8. I remember correctly, you know, just reading some of your articles and reading some of your tweets, you were still kind of a Helfrich supporter during that 4-8 year, because to be fair to Helfrich, they were only a year removed from obviously making, or 2 years removed, excuse me, from making the national championship and winning the Heisman. Then they have the Vernon Adams year, which was still a really good year, and Vernon was hurt that year with his finger issue. And then, of course, they had a really bad year. But you were still kind of a Helfrich supporter after that 4-8 season. Is that right, or am I off on that?
Oh, no. I fundamentally believe that firing that entire staff 2 years after going to the national championship game, 2 years after what I call the greatest season ever, 2 years after winning Heisman, to me, it was just doggish. Like, I just thought it was wrong. Rob Mullins made his decision for a variety of different reasons. I know there's a lot of people who supported the move for different reasons. Helfrich made some mistakes, there's no doubt. But I was kind of taken aback during that time at sort of how the narratives were being floated and how inaccurate people were being with some of the things that they were blaming him for and not including Chip in some of the blame for in terms of the recruiting and the roster being depleted, especially on defense. I mean, Chip had his fingerprints all over that as well. And I believe that they were going to turn it around. A lot of that staff had been around when they faltered in 04, turned it around, then faltered again in 06 and turned it around. I think they were going to learn from some certain mistakes. I also believe that 2016 was extremely young and had more injuries than I'd ever seen. I mean, they lost. I mean, think about the guys they lost for the season that year. They lost Crosby for the season, Devin Allen in the same game at Nebraska. Freeman got banged up that year. Wasn't the same most of the year. Dwayne Stanford went out. Johnny Reagan, the only starting senior within the front seven, missed like 6 or 7 games. Like, Taj Griffin was gone for the season after a few games. Like, it was just a mess. You had a young quarterback, you had a young offensive line. I just truly believe they were going to turn it around. And I also believe that whoever was going to be the coach was going to turn it around. Like, I even predicted that, you know, with Herbert in place and the offensive line, whoever was going to be a coach is going to win about 8 games in 2017 and then have a chance with a future first-round pick quarterback who I was saying was going to be that, you know, as recently as or as early as the Cal game. I was like, this guy's going to be a first-round pick in 4 years, that you would have a chance to win the conference in 18 or 19, and they ended up doing that last year. So, yeah, I think it was kind of doggish. And I also think it's kind of funny that, you know, when they fired him, who'd they hire? Their seventh choice. Like, they went out hunting for coaches, and no one would take that job for a lot of different reasons. So you know, and there's some Ducks fans out there who still hold that against me, which I find amusing because it's like, dude, think about it. I'm basically saying that the coaching staff who put Oregon on the map and is walking around with a ton of conference championship rings and Rose Bowl rings and Fiesta Bowl rings should have been given a chance to turn it around, and you think that's wrong? That just is weird to me. Anyway.
So let me follow up then. If you disapprove of the firing of Helfrich, which you explained very well, then what did you think about the Willie Taggart hire in particular?
Well, I made several predictions right before they fired Helfrich. One of them was they're not going to go out and get a marquee hire, which I got slammed for because, oh, this is Oregon. People are going to be dying to come here. And I just didn't believe that. So they, you know, I wrote and I stand by this. There's a few people at Oregon, one person doesn't work there anymore, who have challenged me on this number, but I think it's absolutely accurate. Taggart was their seventh choice. They interviewed Taggart to get the minority interview out of the way. That's why they interviewed him first. Because you got to interview a person of color before you can hire someone in the state, right? So they interviewed him first, and then they moved on with no intentions whatsoever of hiring him. And they made offers to a lot of different people. Some interviewed, some discussed it, some said no right away. And then they kept striking out, and then Rob Mullen circled back to Taggart because he liked what he heard from Taggart. He kind of thought this is a young, exciting coach who bring a different swag, a different attitude. I kind of like this guy. And so they ended up hiring him basically by default, which was one of my things. Is like, you're not going to get a marquee guy who's more accomplished than Helfrich, and they did not. But I thought, you know, the grand scheme of things, because of his recruiting prowess, I thought it was a good roll of the dice, because if he can be the type of guy who can get, you know, a wider variety of guys to Eugene, then it could pay off. And he was killing it in the recruiting area. So it definitely worked out, but, you know, it wasn't the marquee hire they wanted when they first set out after firing Helfrich.
That's well said. And then a guy who's doing even better on the recruiting trail is Mario Cristobal, obviously. Ducks have the nation's number 3 class for 2021 right now. 5-star quarterback Ty Thompson. He's actually been committed for a while and then was elevated to a 5-star recently, depending on which sites you use. Dante Thornton is a receiver who committed the other day, and he's a highly sought-after kid from Baltimore. And Oregon has a bunch of great recruits in this class. Troy Franklin is another top receiver. It's considered the best receiver class in program history. And I'm not a guy who gets like uber wrapped up in recruiting rankings, but that this has to mean something. And I've definitely read the articles over the years of, you can't win a national championship unless you have a couple top 10 recruiting classes on your roster, blah, blah, blah. How do you explain what Cristobal has been able to do on the recruiting trail, and just what are your thoughts on his tenure so far?
Yeah. So one of the things, you know, that I was saying around the Helfrich time was, I said, look, I don't believe they can find someone who can consistently recruit in the top 10 to Eugene. And that at the same time, the staff, I kind of lacked a bit. I thought they would pick it back up and recruit better. But there were two major factors that were going on. One, there was still negative recruiting going on against that staff because they were on probation because of the Chip Kelly, Willie Lyles fiasco. And I think that ended in 16, or I think that might have ended that year. And two, there was a rule change in recruiting that allowed schools to pay for families to come on trips as well. And the Oregon staff of Helfrich and those guys were wanting that rule to get changed because they believed, and I remember talking to Don Pelham about this, they believed that once they got families on campus, it'd be a wrap. Like, it'd be so much easier for them to recruit to Oregon if they could pay for these families to fly there who couldn't afford to send, you know, the entire family on a recruiting trip. So Taggart, when he came in, he immediately benefited from those two things. One, they were off probation. Two, he was able to fly in whoever he wanted to during recruiting trips, and he started killing it. And when he left, he had the number one rated class on Scout, I think, and top 5 in Rivals and 24/7. So he was just crushing it. And then Cristobal picked it up. Now, his first class after Taggart leaving, I think, was in the teens. And then his second one was 7, right? And then last year dropped back into the teens. And this year they're looking at top 5. But Cristobal is a master recruiter, and he's done a great job. And what Taggart did and what Cristobal has done, they were just recruiting differently than the previous staff. They were more savvy in social media. They were more aggressive. I think one of the mistakes Helfrich made was that, you know, and I tried to warn about this too, is that I think he was relying more on, we're going to find men of Oregon, we're going to find these gems who are going to fit in our system, and everything's going to be fine. And one of the things I warned about in 2012 was that the end was coming post Mariota, regardless of whether it was Chip or anyone else, because the whole conference was changing. The conference in 2010, when they went undefeated, only had two top 25 teams, Oregon and Stanford. By 2014-15, you had five or six finishing the season in the top 25. And so the dynamic of the conference was changing, and eventually they were going to have to recruit to keep up, because the blur offense wasn't just going to wow people anymore. They were going to still score points, but everyone else was doing the same thing or playing defense a little differently. So you had to elevate recruiting. And so one of the things I said was, look, if you can find a guy who can recruit in the top 10, that would be the only way I think you would justify moving off of that staff, if you really didn't feel like they could pick it up in that area, which I still believe they would have. I think they would have changed their ways and got back to where they had been before, because it's not like they'd never recruited in the, you know, in the 11, 10, 9 range they had. But going with someone like Taggart, who was just a master recruiter, getting someone like Keith Hayward, who's amazing, and then Cristobal on top of that, and then Cristobal takes that over for Taggart and keeps it going, has turned out to be, you know, a great thing in terms of getting a pipeline of talent coming in that Oregon has never been able to attract on a consistent basis.
All really good points. So we've talked Cristobal, Taggart, Chip, Bellotti, a lot of men at Oregon, and I know we have some other topics that we want to talk to you about, but let me wrap up my end of the questions for Oregon with this. One of the big things, big talking points over the last few years with the Ducks football team has been the play calling of Arroyo. I don't remember what your stance was on this, kind of looking back at your material over the years. Did you have a strong feeling or take about Arroyo and his play calling during his time with the Ducks?
I find one of the more, what's the word I'm looking for here? Just not mundane. Mundane is not the word. Just one of the more, like, just, I can't pinpoint the word I want, but it's just tired just listening to people cry about play calling. It's like, I don't think people really understand what goes into play calling and why a certain play is called. And most people don't understand the difference between a play being a bad call and a play not working. Like, you can call a great play and it cannot work and someone screws it up, or the defense makes a great play. Like, take the Seahawks Super Bowl. You know, everyone keeps crying, they should have given it to Marshawn. They should have given it to Marshawn. Well, you know, maybe they could have given it to Marshawn. Maybe he scores. But the bottom line is, Malcolm Butler made an amazing read and play. That's why they lost. Not because they didn't give it to Marshawn, because Malcolm Butler made a great play. And so sometimes I got annoyed watching Oregon games and being on Twitter and just hearing people cry and not understand what they were actually seeing. And so what I saw, and I actually would go back and watch the games closer, is that you had, you know, a lot of people saying, we need to go downfield more, right? We need to be more aggressive. Is that what you're alluding to? I'm asking you that. Hello?
Yeah, I guess I would just say in general that, I mean, there was a lot of noise about it, right? So just,
yeah, but a lot,
you know,
of it,
it seemed to be. Yeah, I would say that was one of the biggest criticisms of Royal.
Okay, so but here was the problem. Like, take the Auburn game. I remember people crying about the Auburn game. If they would have called more downfield passes in that game, Justin Herbert leaves in an ambulance. And I'm not saying that facetiously. Like, if you go back and you watch that game, which I did, and you break down each play, whenever they called a pass play in which the receivers were going to run either intermediate to deep routes, he had hardly any time. The offensive line was getting worked by Auburn. And I think, God, I did a tie break on this. I think he was like 3 of 11 or something like that on any pass play in which he took a 3-step drop from shotgun, which is the equivalent of a 5-step drop from under center. The most of the passes he completed were quick screens, right? They threw a ton of them. Well, why are they doing that? Well, they're doing it because they know they're going to have trouble protecting anything else. And that proved itself out in the game. Now, there was the deep crossing route to Johnny Johnson on the play action pass, I think it was. He hit Johnny Johnson for a deep crossing route. And there was actually a blown coverage on that. They screwed up the coverage. And then there was the one we got when he threw the touchdown pass to Webb, right? When he threw it up for grabs to Webb, and Webb out jumped the DB. Remember that play? Well, on that play, he got flushed out of the pocket. He got flushed out of the pocket and got hit as he threw it. So those are really your only two. Yeah, you still there?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Where'd you lose me?
No, you're good. Go ahead. Okay.
No, you're good. We're agreeing with you.
Oh, sorry. So that, you know, and he got knocked out of the game Herbert did. And there were other times where he was just running for his life where no one was open in time for him to get rid of the ball. So the only thing that kept him in that game was the quick passes, those quick screens to Red and Johnson, et cetera, et cetera. So when people were complaining about that, I'm like, you guys aren't paying attention, don't know anything about football. They cannot control the line of scrimmage. If they try and air it out, you know, deep passes, he's going to get destroyed. Plus, guess what else they were lacking? They don't have dynamic receivers like that. Their best two receivers were two slot guys. Basically, I call them slot. I mean, Johnny Johnson would play outside, but he's a slot guy to me. And Jalen Redd. Those guys are not blowing the top off the defense. So you don't have guys who are getting vertical, stretching things out, and being that dynamic downfield where they're going to run a 15, 20-yard dig in fast enough time to get open and get separation before Herbert's on his back. And so that was the problem. One, your offensive line couldn't handle really good pass rushers. And two, you didn't have the dynamic receivers. So the idea you were going to go downfield and be more aggressive was just ridiculous. And that's why they called the games the way they called them. Now, we'll see what Moorhead does. Is, you know, the what they're saying right now is he's being more aggressive. They're going downfield more. And that's all well and good, but you better have the receivers who can get open, and you have a fully brand new offensive line without your anchor that you're going to be doing this with, and a new green quarterback. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
I totally see your point. I see both sides. I thought the Arroyo criticism personally was warranted. I mean, look at what Herbert's doing in the NFL with a pretty banged up O-line, like three of their
but
three
he's
best
got,
O-line
but he's got receivers. But he's got
He has some very good receivers.
And,
yep.
And the most of his big plays are coming off blitzes. So other teams were not blitzing heavy against Oregon to get pressure. They didn't need to. So yeah, if someone blitzes the house, you can go down, and someone gets open downfield, you can go deep. But if you look at most of his touchdowns, they're coming, well, they're either in the red zone or they're coming off of blitzes or blown coverages, like the one he threw to Mike Williams against New Orleans down the right sideline. I mean, you know, you or I could have scored on that. The corner just let him go. So, I mean, people are trying to make this equivalency between what happened at Oregon, what's happening at San Diego, at the Chargers, but it's apples and oranges. It's two completely different animals. Oregon did not have those types of receivers. They don't have anyone close to a Keenan Allen who can get open against anybody. They had one guy on their roster last year who was that kind of guy. And they didn't have anyone like Mike Williams as well. So, yeah, offensive line, definitely not great, but he has much more dynamic receivers. So they could have gone downfield more maybe against some teams, but against the good teams where they're more cautious, I believe they did that for self-preservation for Herbert.
So we could talk about the Ducks for hours with our guy Aaron Fentress and go back and forth. The fun thing about talking to you is, like, we can disagree, but like it's a fun disagreement, which I like. But quickly, as we wrap up our Ducks chat here before we move on to a couple other topics, just quickly your thoughts for this year's Oregon team expectations, what you're looking for, and do you think a Pac-12 team can make the college football playoff if they go undefeated?
It's tough to say what Oregon's gonna look like. I think one of the cool things about college football is always the mystery each year when you have brand new dudes. You know, think of it like, you know, the NFL, if you sign like six new starting free agents every year, that's 6 to 10 or whatever. And this year, you're looking at what, 12 new starters probably? One, because they lost guys just from last year in general. And then two, because of the opt outs with Sewell and Holland and Breeze and Graham. I mean, that's just devastating. And Oregon's never lost that much talent in 1 year because you've never basically had two moments where you lost players because of the COVID situation. So it's tough. It's tough for me to believe this is a 7-0 team. Then again, the schedule is not necessarily going to be that tough when you have the North, which doesn't look very strong, and then you're playing UCLA, which we all know is pretty mediocre. So I think if Shuck and the offensive line click, you know, if the offensive line play is there and Shuck is legit, then I think you can go 7-0. If either one is a little shaky, you're going to drop one or two. You just are. I mean, you know, look at last year. Last year, they lost to Arizona State unexpectedly. They had to fight for their life to beat Washington State, right? And then even the Oregon State game. I mean, what was 17-10 in the fourth quarter? And Oregon State was awful. So I look at that team and look at the near losses, and I'm like, well, how am I supposed to believe this team's going to go undefeated even with a soft schedule? I just don't know until I see. Now, first game against Stanford, they go out and they win 54-10. Then, okay, yeah, maybe I'll buy it after that. So we'll see. Now, should a 7-0 team get in the playoffs? Man, I don't know, man. If it's To me, if it's 7-0 with a weak schedule versus 9-1 from another conference, or 8-1, or even 8-2, 9-2, if the two losses are strong, I don't see how Oregon gets by those teams. I don't think Oregon's going to get the respect that they would need to get to overcome that, even if they're 7-0. One, because of their schedule, and two, because of who they have. They lost 11 NFL guys, yeah. 11 guys to the NFL. Counting the opt-out. So that's tough to overcome from an image standpoint across the country, I believe.
Sure. All right. Let us move on to a topic that our listeners have pounded us about and that we have interacted on Twitter about. It's Gary Anderson. He left $12 million on the table when he left Corvallis. Uh-huh. I don't know if I call it unexplainable. Maybe it's just one hell of a gesture, but we know you've heard theories as to why, Fentress. What can you share with us?
Oh, dude, I can't share that stuff, man. That's just salacious. If it hasn't been written, I can't talk about it.
Wow. Really?
Well, if I had anything that concrete in terms of the rumors I've heard, which and the stuff I've heard is not even like on the record, or most of the stuff is just hearsay, really. So it's like for me to say that from a journalistic standpoint would be, I think, irresponsible. Let's just say that I have heard that there was some type of scandal that maybe led to a situation where it was best that he moved along, and that's why he did what he did. Everything else would be hearsay, salacious rumors, unsubstantiated stuff that I just would never repeat.
So I totally get that. But just looking at this logistically, leaving 12, it's not like he got fired, right? He quit and left $12 million on the table. That just seems so bizarre, right? Like, can you ever remember anyone doing that? It doesn't seem like something that would happen on regular terms.
100%. That's why it has scandal written all over it. It either has scandal written all over it, or he's just one of a kind, you know, mm-hmm. Because if let's put it this way, unless you're going to get fired for cause and lose that money anyway, there's no way people are going to leave that type of money on the table. Like it's just free money, right? Now it'd be offset by taking another job, what have you, but still you're going to take the money. I mean, when Oregon fired Helfrich, they tried to go back to him and try to negotiate a settlement. He was like, you better give me what I want. And I think they did give him a little less, but they gave it all up front, so we don't have to wait for it. Taggart, Florida State tried to come to him and try and reach some kind of settlement. And Taggart said straight up, what does my contract say? You owe me $18 million? You're giving me $18 million. Like, I'm not negotiating anything with you. Why would I? Same thing with Anderson. If they were going to fire Anderson just for being a bad coach, Anderson's going to take that money. So clearly there was something going on that caused him to try and save face, because maybe he knew that if he got fired for a cause and a violation of some clause in his contract, he wasn't going to get that money anyway. And he was going to be embarrassed by a scandal. So, but this is all speculation. Like we're piecing things together to reach an educated guesstimate. Right. And so that's why I would never talk about any details of anything I've ever heard, because I just can't. It's just salacious. I can't prove it. I have no way of knowing if it's true. But it does look like a situation where the best scenario for him was to just leave the money on the table, make it look like he's doing something great, and move on with his life.
And we love breaking down the media side of sports on this podcast. And we followed Canzano. Canzano would tweet out text messages from Gary Anderson. That was pretty much the main reporting that was going on during that time when the Beavers were so bad. And I essentially the text, I read through them earlier today. I don't have them pulled up on a tab or anything, but a lot of them was Gary just saying like, I'm not getting along with my assistant coaches. I hired the wrong guys, yada, yada, yada. That was essentially what he was saying. Just in general, I mean, why do you think from a media perspective, why do you think this story was so underreported? Like if this was Saban or a coach at any major school, quite frankly, I would imagine this would be a giant national story. And maybe that's the reason right there, because it's in Corvallis and it's in a, you know, a program that's been one of the bottom tier programs in college football. But why was this story even locally, like Oregonian guys, Register Guard folks, why was it, or, you know, local TV folks, why do you think the story itself was pretty underreported?
Well, what do you mean by underreported? You mean in terms of getting...
Like, there just wasn't much on it. There wasn't really much questioning to Scott Barnes. There wasn't much questioning to, I don't know, Gary Anderson's agent. I didn't really see many stories, many journalists trying to get to the bottom of why Gary just left $12 million out there.
Yeah. Well, okay. One, I didn't cover the team. I've never covered that beat full time. I've written a little bit here and there about the Beavers.
I'm not saying you. I'm just saying in general.
I'm just saying in terms of, I'm just sort of setting up my point of view is not one of someone who was deeply involved with that, who would know all the ins and outs. But no, I think one, like you said, it's Oregon State and Corvallis. I think two, there was something probably there that was really, really difficult to get to, especially if the two main players, the AD and the head coach, are not playing ball and not giving up what you would hope they would give up. And two, you know, the text messages that Canzano published, if I remember correctly, like those weren't ill-gotten, like they were given to him. And so I think that just became the narrative that, you know, that Anderson wanted out there, was that it just wasn't working out and he didn't think he could fix it. So, I mean, that part was out there. Whether or not that was 100% the truth, you know, I think a lot of people questioned that and wonder if there was more to it. And I think that's legitimate to wonder about because of the money he left on the table. But, you know, I mean, I guess each publication has to ask itself, how much do they want to devote to trying to, you know, dig deep into this thing and, you know, stake out parts of Corvallis to try and get information, especially if it's of a personal nature, you know, because then you get into, you know, violations of privacy. And he's just a football coach. He's not a politician, you know. So I could see where, especially in this media market, people backed off, whereas in some media markets, yeah, they probably would have been more aggressive.
Last question on our guy, Gary Fentress. Are you leaving that $12 million on the table? I would assume not.
Not unless I had something to hide. I mean, if I had something to hide and it was better for me in the long run to just move along and get a job somewhere else, then no. I mean, like, it, you know, I'm going to make them fire me and get my money, of course. But see, here's the thing. I don't think Oregon State was going to fire him. They weren't going to fire him for having a bad football team. Oregon State couldn't afford to just fire him and pay him $12 million and hire a new coach. Like, they can't be running around doing that. So I don't believe that he was going to get fired. Plus, it was was that year three?
Year four.
Year four. Year four. I mean, they were pretty bad. And they had shown some, if I remember correctly, they had shown some signs of getting better prior to that year, then kind of slid backwards. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean,
yeah, they went 4-8. I have it in front of me. They went 4-8 in year three, and he got carried off the field for that win over Oregon. Yeah, and he signed Oregon, and he signed an extension after going 4-8.
Yeah. Now, what were they?
That's right.
What were they doing for that? 15.
Man, I don't know. His record overall was 7 wins, 23 losses in his 3.5 seasons in Corvallis. Yikes.
I think 2015 going into that season, I was kind of like, I think they're going to make a bowl game. I was trying to be very positive. I thought they could win 6. I was wrong.
Yeah. My final Gary question before we move on to just a couple
I had no
second.
Idea we were going to talk this much about Gary Anderson. I forgot he was even the coach of Oregon State, but go ahead.
It's one of the all-time mysteries in our state, Fentress. we need Clearly. To get to the bottom of this. How, if you're a journalist, which you are a great journalist, I love reading your stuff, what's your approach to getting to the bottom of this story? Are you staking out Scott Barnes' office? Are you flying to Logan, Utah, and demanding answers from Gary Anderson? Or how do you get to the bottom of this as a journalist?
I think that ship has sailed, but I mean, look, if there was some type of scandal, I think you have to go to the source of the scandal and start there and then work your way out from there. If that person won't give you what you want, then you work around them and try and get people who know them and see what they'll say on or off the record. But, you know, there was a big Bilotti related scandal back in the 2000s, you know, that you know, was personal and had a lot of, you know, just, it was just kind of a scandal. And I think it kind of got touched on here and there, but was never deeply reported on because of the personal nature. And I do think, you know, to me, politicians are like 100%, you know, not off limits. You go after anything, except for their kids, obviously. But, you know, politicians do something, you're all over them. I think if coaches do something in their personal life, something's going on, you know, I just don't feel like, unless it's illegal or unless it hurts the program, like, I don't feel like it's something that should be completely dug up and you know, made public, unless, especially if you have to go through a bunch of hoops and leap over hurdles to try and get to it. It almost seems kind of TMZ-ish to me. So anyway, that's what I would do.
Yeah, no, that's a good take. All right, just a couple rapid fire. I don't know if it's totally rapid fire, but just a couple questions left here with Aaron Fentress of the Oregonian. I'm going to go Trailblazers, and then I know Big Tony's got a question or two for you. This team has not been able to get over the hump. They obviously made the Western Conference Finals, which is, you know, I don't know if that's the ceiling for the franchise or not at the moment, but I'm just, as a guy who's covered the team and who's been in the area for a long time, how do the Blazers get over the hump, or at least just get ultra competitive with the top seeds in the NBA, or is that even possible? And my one trade proposal, which Philadelphia might laugh at this, but we have a disgruntled Joel Embiid. So my trade proposal would be Portland sends CJ and Nurk to Philly for Embiid, and then like a role player like Josh Richardson, ooh, a 3-and-D guy. I don't know if I actually emailed that to Neil Olshey. Of course, he didn't respond.
Did you really?
But I did, yes. But anyways, just talk Blazers to me. Give me your thoughts on all that.
So, you know, I've followed the NBA since I was a little kid. And, you know, one of the truths about the NBA is you got to have the dudes. You know what I mean? You got to have the superstars, the transcendent guys, and probably two of them, right? And I know people love Lillard, and he's a great point guard, but he's just not one of those guys. He just isn't. He isn't a Magic, a Kobe, a Bird, a Jordan, a Wilt, a Kareem, you know, Karl Malone, Barkley, Patrick Ewing. They didn't win titles, but Olajuwon, Shaq. You know, he's just LeBron, Durant, Curry. He's just not on that level. He just isn't, as good as he is. He just had a career year. You know, shooting percentage was 46. I think his three-point percentage was 40. You know, I don't remember top of my head exactly the numbers, but if you go compare those numbers to Curry, like, I think his three-point shooting percentage of 40 ranks like eighth all-time on Curry's list. Like, his 46% ranks like seventh or something. His effective ranks like ninth. Like, Curry's had eight better seasons than what Lillard just had in his career season. So if you don't have one of those dudes, how are you going to win it? The only way you can win it is if you just have a ton of, you know, number twos, and you catch a really good team in a bad series, which is how Detroit won it, what, 15 years ago with Billups and Rip Hamilton and Ben Wallace. They upset the Lakers with Shaq and Kobe. They only won that series because Shaq and Kobe were feuding like a, you know, old married couple, right? I mean, other than that, there's no way Detroit beats that team. So Portland has to find a way to get a guy like that. And so it cracks me up when people are like, Neil Olshey has failed to build around Lillard. Well, I hate to say this, but you don't build a championship team around Lillard. Lillard is the final piece to someone else's championship team, because you don't have LeBron. You don't have Durant. Who's won the championship the last 5 years? Warriors or LeBron, right? So how are you going to contend with that without those dudes? And then now Toronto won it. Well, how did Toronto win? Because Durant and Clay were out. That's the only reason why Toronto won it. And you don't have a Kawhi Leonard. So how are you going to contend? There's just no way possible unless you're able to get one of those types of guys. Now, the perfect scenario would be you should have drafted Giannis in 2000, whatever that was, instead of 2000. When they dropped McCollum? That was 13, right?
Something like that. Yeah. The year.
So there was your path. McCollum goes 10. Giannis goes 15. So had Neil Olshey had the foresight to look into Giannis's future and know he was going to become a megastar, boom, Blazers are contending because you got Lillard and Giannis. But like 13 other teams, he didn't see that in Giannis, and so he missed out. He missed the boat on that opportunity. So that's just, I mean, that's just the story. And the Blazers fans like want to get mad at Olshay, and they believe they should be able to contend, and they need to make this move and that make that move. Every team in the NBA is saying that, except for the top three or four teams, who are pretty much predictable almost every year because of who they have on their roster. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be tough, man. Like, you know, I think where they are right now, I think I wrote about this the other day. Like, Dame's 30 now, right? So he's going to start climbing. Pretty soon he's going to be 32. Everyone's going to look at one day and go, oh, my God, Dame's 32. Okay? He hasn't suffered a major injury yet. But how many years of greatness does he really have? 4 or 5 max? So they have maybe a 4 or 5 year window to go get a couple other dudes. And I think they have to really look into trading CJ. I know Neil Olshay has said they don't want to, but you are not going to win a title, I don't believe, with 2 6-foot-2, 6-foot-3 shoot first guards who don't play great defense. So I'll ask you guys this question. How many teams in the last 40 years have won a championship built around a 6-foot-2 guard as their best player?
I mean, the Warriors team.
Warriors, right? Obviously.
Curry's 6'3".
Curry's about 6'3". Let me just give you this real quick. That year that the Warriors won 73 games, was that 2014, 2015? I think it was.
It was 2015, 2016.
Okay. Yeah. Did they win the title in 2014-2015, though?
Yes, they beat.
So that year the Warriors, and by the way, I do think Curry is a little better than Dame. I'm always going to rep my guy Dame, but I admit that Curry's a better shooter, probably better, definitely a better player. But it's close. And that year that the Warriors won the title, Steph averaged 23.8 points a game and 7.7 assists on 48% shooting. Dame Lillard this year averaged 30 points, 8 assists on 46% shooting. So it's not like it's impossible for Dame to play on a team that's Warriors-esque in terms of he's got a nice defensive number two and then a Draymond-type player. My point is, you said something to the effect of you can't win a title with Dame as your best player. I would disagree with that with those stats to back it up. What do you think about that?
Well, you're pointing at stats based on volume and number of shots. I mean, you know,
but that's efficiency too.
What was Curry?
He was 1% better shooting.
3 points? Or 3-pointers?
Field goal overall. 3-pointer, Steph was 44%. This year, Dame was 40.
What was effective?
I don't have that, like, the deep stats, but those are I'm just on the ESPN game log. But I mean, it's like 1-2% difference field goal and then 4% 3-point.
Right. So, okay, now we come into the volume question, because here's one thing Blazers fans will never admit to. Russell Westbrook's better. Is Russell Westbrook better than Dame?
God, no.
Well, Russell Westbrook has the MVP, and Russell Westbrook has averaged a triple-double.
You take Russell over Dame?
No, you're not seeing my flip on you here. You're trying to go to Curry and say, well, look what Dame did, and Curry did that year. So Dame's right there.
Dame was even better in the postseason than those regular season stats.
You're talking about pure stats. Russell Westbrook has an MVP and averages a triple-double, but you would never admit he's better than Dame. My point being is, yes, Curry may only average 23 that year, but when the games were on the line, you know, and shots had to be made, Curry was on a different level, which is why he ended up winning a couple MVPs. Plus, and the bigger factor is, yeah, he had Clay and he had Draymond. Well, how is Portland
that's
ever
what
gonna
I'm
get
saying.
A Clay
yeah,
or Draymond?
That's the bigger factor.
How is Portland going to get a Clay or a Draymond? I don't know if they are.
Should have been Bam. Bam Adebayo.
So, I mean, to your point, you're saying that Lillard's close to Curry. Therefore, if Curry could win a title as the best player on his team, maybe Dame could if you surrounded him. I mean, maybe. But like I said, you know, Dame just had his best season ever, and overall it ranks like eighth best on Curry's best seasons ever. And Curry is a two-time MVP guy. I don't see the path. And to answer my question before, Curry in his first championship was the best player on his team, 6'2", 6'2"-ish, 3. I think he's 6'2". I don't think he's 6'3", but whatever. And then Isaiah, you have to go back to Isaiah Thomas. So you're talking about doing something that has only been done by two franchises in 40 years. And then to have two backcourt mates who are 6'2"-ish, 6'3"-ish, and McCollum and Dame, Well, no one's won a title that way, except you have to go back to Isaiah Thomas and Dumars. Dumars was more, he's like 6'3", 6'4". So that would be the comp. But, you know, you're talking about a different era and when they had the greatest probably defensive front court ever. I mean, their defensive front court was ridiculous. So that's something that's only happened once in the last 40 years. So how do you figure a team's going to be able to do it, you know, do something that's only happened once in 40 years with Dame and CJ? It just doesn't make logical sense because at the end of the game, they're just too little. Like when the Lakers, did you notice? I mean, in that series with the Lakers, when the Lakers cranked it up and said, let's go, and they put Danny Green on Lillard. I remember he had Lillard trapped in the corner. And Danny Green's what, 6'6", 6'7", way longer and bigger. And Lillard just had no answer. Lillard's not good enough to spin and dribble and juke that guy and get to the basket and dunk on somebody or draw a foul. He's just not that kind of guy. He can step back and shoot a 40-footer. But you're not going to win championships doing that all the time. And then you go to CJ, what's he going to do? He's too little. And then on defense, they're just too little. So you've got to get some bigger, longer wings who can create different types of shots to complement a Dame. And, you know, Paul George would be ideal if he were available. Kawhi would be ideal. But those guys are hard to come by.
Okay. Big Tony, you can take it from here.
Yeah, I want to be mindful of time. I know we could go on all night, and this has obviously been a great conversation. I think my most important question that I have left is about advice that you would give potential, you know, the next potential Aaron Fentress or anyone else that's coming up in the industry. So for any, and we always do this with all of our guests that come on and talk sports media, Fentress, for any young aspiring professionals that want to become more successful or just at least successful in the sports media industry in today's landscape, what's the best piece of advice that you could give them?
Oh, I would say just try to be versatile. I hate the idea that people try and pigeonhole people into certain things. Like you're this, you're that. It drives me bananas. Like you see some of these new entities will come along and they're going to hire someone to cover the NFL. They want to hire someone who's been covering the NFL the last couple of years. And the same thing with like, they act like journalists are just one trick ponies. And, you know, back when journalism was journalism, I mean, it still is to a certain extent, but you know, the ethics and the guidelines and the training of major newspapers is kind of being, you know, diluted because newspapers are fading out of existence. But you learn to be able to cover anything, like parachute into anything. I mean, I've made this statement before, and I would love to find out if it's true by doing some kind of survey. I think I've covered more different topics than any journalist working in the Northwest. And I guarantee you I'm in the top 10 because before I covered sports, I covered news. I covered crime. I've covered homicides, murder trials, fatal car accidents, fatal fires, prostitution stings, sexual assault cases, child sexual abuse cases, murder, suicide. Like, I've covered all sorts of crazy things in the crime world. And I covered education for 2 years. School districts, going to school board meetings. I covered news, government, county government. In sports, I've covered preps. I've covered Portland State football and basketball. I covered UAP women's soccer. I covered the Lumberjacks, indoor lacrosse, and they were here. The Ducks, the Beavers, the Pac-12, the Mariners and MLB, the Seahawks, NFL. So you have to be able to be versatile. You know, I went to the Oregonian. I'd never covered the Blazers full-time before. You know, I'm covering a team that's 3,000 miles away. And I just jumped right into it and just started covering like I've been covering the entire season. And just, you know, I wasn't intimidated or scared to do that because I've jumped into different arenas before and had to cover different things I'd never covered before. So I would say versatility, be able to cover a bunch of different things. Don't just specialize in one, especially when you're coming up, because you never know where your career is going to take you, right? You never know what you're going to end up covering and what the best job is. And you want to be able to show that you can do anything.
Fentress, man, we really appreciate it, dude. You're definitely a guy who I've looked up to in this industry for a long time, and I've been reading you since I was growing up here in the Portland suburbs. So definitely appreciate you having me on, man. What is that? Oh, Tualatin.
Okay, Tualatin.
Yeah, man.
So what year did you graduate?
High school, 2011.
So was Ted Rose there? See that?
Yeah. Ted Rose was there. He was our he was the fill-in tennis coach. I was on the tennis team, which was great. And then he was our basketball weights coach and PE coach. He is a great dude. Right.
And then he became he's the AD now, right?
Yeah, he's the AD now. Yeah, he played pro ball overseas, I think.
Yeah, he went to Lake Ridge. I was always jealous of Ted Rose coming up because at Grant, I played in this weak-ass offense and weak quarterback play, and then I played in the Shrine Game, or the State All-Star Game, like the Swab Bowl, for Tom Smythe. And Tom Smythe had this awesome spread offense. This is back in the 80s, right? We were on a spread offense with, reading routes as you go, et cetera, et cetera. And I was so jealous because Ted Rhodes got to play in that offense for Smythe. And then the next year, I think they almost won the state title, but Columbus got hurt. And then the next year with Miotic, they won it all. And I was just always mad. Like, Ted Rhodes got to play in that offense his entire high school career, and I only got to play in it for like a week in one game.
What was he? Nah. What position was he?
Receiver.
He was a receiver. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Because he's a receiver. Damn good basketball player, and I think he played a little pro baseball too. I mean, he's a great athlete in general.
Yeah, he was a triple threat for sure. But yeah, that was my. And we met a couple times over the years. I don't know him, well, but I know him.
Right. Do you guys played against each other at some point?
I think when I, not in high school, but I think he might have been at Lewis and Clark.
Okay.
In my senior year at Pacific. I went to Portland State and then I played at Pacific and we played Lewis and Clark. And I think he might have been on that team, that last team that Smythe had, because he was a year behind me, but I can't remember. It was so far long ago. But anyway, just, you know, it's a small town. Everyone knows someone that everyone else knows.
Totally. Well, best of luck when the Blazer season starts. When is that going to start up in your estimation?
You know, I guess they're looking at January. It's funny because about a month ago, I talked to my ticket rep. We have season tickets. And I'm like, all right, when is this thing going to start? And they were even saying it could be anywhere from December to March. Okay. Their goal is they want fans, right?
Right.
So if they got to push it out because of Corona so they can get fans, they'll push it out. The problem is, like, if you start, they want to do 82 games. So if you push it out to March, think about this. You push it out to March, you go March, April, May, June, July, August, and play off September, October, you creep into the next season's normal start time. So are you going to double cut and go back to back? You kill your players, right? So you almost have to start earlier, and I think condense this season again and then try and get back on schedule next fall in October.
There might be permanent effects from this.
Yeah, I mean, they might permanently move it to start in December all years and just finish in the summer. Maybe that'll be the goal.
What are they telling the media just as far as, like, the way to conduct coverage? Are you getting anything from the Blazers as far as, like, availabilities or just – I mean, it's obviously kind of the dead of off-season now, but
– Yeah, it's off-season now. I mean, you can request players to the team and they can try and set it up, or you can go through their agents. So I'm working on a couple features through agents actually right now. And then when things get heated up again, I'm sure we'll still be back on Zoom for a while. I can't imagine that we're going to come off of those. Like Oregon right now, it's just ridiculous how they're doing. I'm not blaming them. They're just everything Zoom, obviously, which makes sense, but it's kind of random. Like you can't request players. It's just who they pick. So they pick like three players and throw them on a Zoom. So that means everyone's writing the exact same story every day, which is kind of annoying.
So. Cool, man. Well, we'll let you go. You've been far too kind with your time. And hey, go Bears for your sake. And I hope Russell Wilson wins the MVP as a Northwest guy. Oh, that's a boo from you. Okay.
I'm kidding. I like Russ. Russ is a good dude, man. I like covering him. He's awesome.
And our thanks to Aaron Fentress, the Oregonian, for joining us. Fentress, just an awesome guy to have on. Never shy of giving his opinion. And obviously, he's covered a lot of the teams in the state of Oregon for a couple decades now. So, again, our thanks to him. We're going to whip through the rest of this pod kind of quickly, keep it light. Got some college football observations for you. Tua time, John Wall. I'll give my college football picks for the weekend, and then Big Tony has a quick Ed O rant. But we'll start quickly with our college football observations. Bama and Clemson's offense just teetering on being historically good. Bama's receivers are just unreal. And remember, they had Ruggs and Judy last year, who I think could have come back for this season on top of Mechie, Devontae Smith, and Jalen Waddle. They're looking unreal. Clemson dropped 73 on Georgia Tech. They played four different players at quarterback, including a punter at quarterback. Dabo Swinney has two sons on Clemson, both of whom caught passes in that game. And AP, I know we both like Georgia, and we still feel like they're a playoff caliber team, but Bama's offense is just rolling on another level right now.
It is, but their defense stinks, Chief. This has got to be the worst Bama defense I can remember since I started religiously watching college football. I mean, I'd have to go back and actually look at the numbers in a lower level, but just what I'm seeing week to week, now granted, you know, shorter season, COVID, it's tougher to kind of prepare, and a lot of folks are saying that the tackling isn't there and you know, the delayed start and all that. But, dude, this defense ain't Bama worthy at all. I think the defenses in the past that Alabama had were, you know, really the pride of that football team. And Saban is a defensive guy himself. So to see them get gashed, but, you know, for the most part of each of these weeks, especially to a four-string quarterback who was putting in the work in the first half, Ole Miss, I think they almost hung 50 on him. That defense is a serious concern, man. I get it. Their offense is awesome. Their wide receivers are elite. That defense looks bad, brother. It looks really bad.
And by the way, Matt Golden Corral for Ole Miss football threw 6 picks this weekend. 6. Matt Golden Corral. So that's making that Bama defense look even worse because he looked like Peyton Manning in his prime against them.
Yeah, and not just that, but again, Stetson Bennett is a 4-string quarterback. They pulled that guy out of the SAE tailgate before the game and just said, hey, man, can you throw a couple of short passes and maybe one deep ball? And he was tearing Bama up in the first half.
He was. He looks a lot better than Bo Nix, who continues to soil his pants every week. I've said for a while that Bo Nix ain't it. I think it's just the fact that he was a somewhat hyped recruit, set some Alabama state records, and then his dad played quarterback for Auburn back in the day. I don't know what's going on. He threw 3 picks against South Carolina. South Carolina is just like the definition of a mediocre SEC team. He soiled the sheets again. I think Chad Morris, the OC, needs to treat that offense more like Nick Marshall. Like, Nick Marshall was not a very good passer. There were like a couple moments where he would like chuck up a deep ball and it would work. But in general, he was not a very good passer, but they still made the national title game with Nick Marshall because they treated him like what he was, which is a running quarterback. They need to do that to Bo Nix because Bo Nix is actually a decent scrambler, but he is not a good passer. Seth Williams, who is an incredibly talented receiver on that Auburn team, was screaming at him. They were like fighting on the sideline. I don't know if you saw that, but it's time to turn Bo Nix into a runner because his arm's not going to win you games.
So I agree. I really do. He is a great runner, by the way, very athletic quarterback. And watching the tape on him before he got to Auburn, because that first game of his career was against Oregon, I wanted to see what he looked like in all those crappy standard definition rivals highlights. But he's just not it as a passer. Last year, 16 touchdowns, 6 interceptions, not that many yards. This year, 5 touchdowns, 4 interceptions. And as you mentioned, he soiled himself again against South Carolina. If you're the quarterback for Auburn, you better be ready to go toe for toe against Alabama. You can't be losing to South Carolina. This is sad, too, because you know that with Malzahn and his offense, you can get away with not the best quarterback in the world, but ideally you'd like to have a guy that can make some throws to stretch the defense just because of how creative they are. He's not it, man. I completely agree. So what do? They bring in the backup? Do they go 4-string like Georgia did? Pull a guy out of the stands at half to try that Geico halftime throw?
Yeah, I mean, they had Joey Gatewood, who's a really good athlete, last year as their backup. They bring him in for like goal line situations, and they almost treated him like a wildcat player. He transferred to Kentucky, and so now they're screwed. Their backup, I think I've seen him, but he's just not good. He's like a slow white guy, so they're not bringing him in. So they got to stick with Nix because he is a good athlete, and they gotta run the ball with Bo Nix. He's probably better than Jarrett Garantano, who threw back-to-back pick sixes for the Vols, as the Vols once again soiled the sheets and lost to Kentucky 34-7. I've been saying this forever. Tennessee has actually had pretty good recruiting classes, but they've had terrible quarterback play dating back to, I mean, basically Peyton Manning. Josh Dobbs was decent for like a year. under Butch Jones when they kind of fraudulently won like 8 or 9 games. But ever since Derek Dooley, you know, came in and soiled that QB room, the Vols just desperately need a quarterback. And you know, they're playing Alabama this weekend. That might be my mortal lock to go Bama -21 in that game, because the Vols, I mean, that game has 52-10 written all over it.
Is that such a big lock where you got to make the drive all the way to the Spirit Mountain Casino and Resort MGM Sportsbook to make the bet?
I might have to, folks. I might have to do it, and I'll dial you up if I do, because I got a couple
of potential
locks too.
So for context, that's like an hour and a hour to hour and a half drive for you, right?
It's like an hour and 5 minutes. It's not bad.
Okay, so for context for the folks out there, when we talk about a make the drive lock, this is what we're referring to, because the Oregon Scoreboard app does not currently have college sports available to bet on. And so for your college football fix, you got to drive to Spirit Mountain and use their MGM Sportsbook. I don't know why. Kate Brown, you got to get on that. But that's the current climate. And if you see a line like Bama -21 against Jarrett, guaranteed pick six, Garantano, you got to hammer it.
I agree, dude. That is looking like a massive lock, as is Ohio State -26 against Nebraska. I mean, Ohio State's third stringers would probably beat Nebraska by 26, let alone their first stringers. I that's my other mortal lock for the weekend, is Ohio State -26 against the Farmers from Nebraska.
Remember when Frost was introduced and everyone was creaming their pants because he went 12-0 at UCF? And now he's not good at all for Nebraska, and they're getting destroyed every week. It's probably going to be another rough fall campaign for them too. I mean, the Big Ten is not an easy conference by any means. And when you start off with Ohio State, that's probably going to be a 30-piece with fries. So I don't see this getting any easier for Frost. And I think that is a damn near mortal lock as well. We might need you to make the drive for a couple games this weekend.
Might have to. What happened to Mississippi State, Tony? Because they go out and beat LSU in week one. They look really good doing it. And then all of a sudden, KJ Costello has completely soiled himself in 3 straight games, and they're now 1-3. What happened to the Bulldogs?
What happened is right. They hung a ton of points and a ton of yards. And KJ Costello, well, he looked like a Kyler Murray, you know, Big 12 Heisman winning quarterback with the numbers that he put up. It was like passing league out there. And then the last 3 games after that, he's been terrible. He looks like the KJ Costello from Stanford, who you could not trust at all and would either give you a decent game or a very, very well below average game. He stinks. Mississippi State stinks. I've been watching those games even more closely than other games, but also just like more than just following the box score, because I genuinely cannot wrap my brain around how they're losing and not putting up a lot of points or yards while they're losing. And they can't even block 3 guys on the rush. So it is one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen. It looks to me like the SEC has figured out that Mike Leach, I don't know, it kind of looks like a gimmick, air raid offense right now in one game's worth of tape. So I don't know, man. It doesn't look good for Leach or Costello right now.
Their offensive line is so bad. I just watched the A&M game. They lost 28-14. A&M was rushing 3 and dropping 8, and they were getting to Costello in like 2 seconds. Their O-line is so bad. I don't know if they like had a bunch of guys go down to COVID since that LSU game or what happened, but their O-line is terrible. And by the way, LSU blitzed Costello a ton with like 5-6 guys. That is exactly why you rush 3 and drop 8 against most quarterbacks. I know it's frustrating for fans to see at times when it doesn't work, but dude, that is exactly why you do that, because Mississippi State's O-line has been terrible. Last couple observations. The soiled Seminoles beat North Carolina 31-28. New quarterback Jordan Travis, who also started the Notre Dame game, he's actually a good runner, bad passer, finished 8 of 19 with 1 touchdown and 1 pick, but he ran for 107 yards and 2 touchdowns in the win. My other thought is A&M should probably win out. They have Arkansas, South Carolina, Tennessee, Ole Miss, LSU, and Auburn all on their schedule. Folks, none of those teams are very good at all. And then finally, Big Tony, what's your BYU football take?
Is it appropriate to say that they're back? Because while they're very good right now, they're playing at an elite level against nobody. They're beating up on a bunch of online colleges. Where were they before this? Because I don't ever remember BYU football ever being that great, to be honest. So to say they're back, it's kind of tessitore-ish because I don't know how much weight that it actually holds. And again, they're playing FCS schools every week because of their altered schedule since COVID hit. But they're fun to watch, man. And I think that their quarterback, Zach Wilson, is awesome. That guy is truly a Heisman candidate and is fun to watch, electric, and can make every throw, and is super fast, great athlete. And their skill players are dope, too, and they got a good defense. So I don't even know if it's appropriate to say that BYU's back thus far, but they're fun to watch at the very least.
Yeah, what's crazy about BYU is they were supposed to play a bunch of really good teams this year, and then because of COVID, they literally had to reschedule every single game because they're independent. And so they've been playing, like you alluded to, a bunch of roast beef techs and online colleges. Zach Wilson, 1,600 passing yards, 12 touchdowns, just one pick, 100 rushing yards, 6 rushing touchdowns, so 18 total touchdowns to one pick this year. He's absolutely been balling. And BYU's had some ESPN games against some bad teams, so he's been lighting it up on national television. BYU football, we're not going to declare them fully back, but they're up there. They're up there. All right, I have one quick observation. College football, Georgia-Bama this past Saturday got 9.6 million views. That's more than any NBA or MLB playoff game this season. The recent MLB game one was also one of the lowest rated MLB. Actually, it was the lowest rated World Series game in history, I believe, or at least in 40 years since 1968. Here it is from NBC. It's the lowest rated World Series game since 1968. Also, the NBA ratings massively suffered. They were in the fives and sixes. And I think maybe a little higher than that. And in previous years, they've been like in the teens, 15 or so. Big Tony, what's interesting to me is college football gets way better ratings, and football in general does. And that's probably because there are fewer games. We can talk about that. But the most interesting thing to me here is it seems that college football is significantly more viewed than the NBA in America. But it's not nearly as talked about on debate shows or social media. Like, the NBA ratings have been at all-time lows, but they dominate the conversation on social media and on radio. And I guess my take on why that is because you get to know the players a lot better in the NBA. Some of them are more active on social media. You literally get to see their faces. You get to hear them in interviews, whereas college football, there's new players year in and year out. The NFL, there's so many players on a team that maybe you don't feel like you know the stars as well. But it's kind of crazy. Like, the football ratings are way better than basketball or baseball ratings, but they're not as fun to talk about as basketball, in my opinion anyway. What's your stance on just kind of that whole observation?
So hear me out on this. I think the way that you phrased this and what you wrote down in the outline is an interesting topic. I personally don't like ratings talk. I think that it leads to a lot of bizarre takes, hot takes, and sometimes like really just, I mean, why would you even go there takes? But for this particular ask, I think it's an interesting question that you pose. And I'll just say, I think a lot of it has to do with the culture. I think that NBA Twitter is a culture in itself, and it stems largely from really dramatic events that occur throughout the entire NBA season, which is a long season, and in the off season as well. So I just don't think that there's enough of that kind of material in the NFL or college football or baseball besides the Chicharro scandal. And then look at the Chicharro scandal that blew up on Twitter. So I think that for there to be an equivalent of NBA Twitter, quote unquote, there needs to be a bigger sample size of a lot of these dramatic events in other sports. That's my take, I would say. And as for the ratings, football is always going to reign supreme in America. It just is what it is.
Agreed. Agreed on those fronts. You got an Edo rant for us, Big Tony?
Yeah, I do. I do. I didn't want to apologize last year because I thought that what I was seeing is exactly what I later in hindsight knew that it entirely was, but it was tough to say in the moment for how good they were playing. It was tough to refute that. It was tough to slander Ed O. But here's my overall point. Chief, Ed O is still a fraud. He's the new Gene Chizik. 1 year under a transcendent QB and first to second round players at every other position, and he wins the national title. Every other year, underachieves. I think they lost to Troy 1 year, if I'm not mistaken. The other years, they were like 8-4, even though they had ridiculously talented players at every position, arguably not quarterback. And it's the same exact staff, except they got rid of one guy. Who's that guy? He's now calling plays for the Carolina Panthers, Joe Brady. We said this all last year, and I think you were the first one to bring this up on the podcast, that Joe Brady is the difference in LSU's offense. This was last year. It was Burrow the year before without Brady, and they stunk on offense. They scored no points at home in a primetime game at Tiger Stadium against Alabama. But they light up all sorts of records last year with Joe Brady. Ed O is the new Gene Chizik, man. He took advantage of a transcendent QB and an all-time play caller who's now not on the staff and first-round talent at every other position. This year, he's getting exposed just like he got exposed all the other seasons despite still having an abundance of talent. Your thoughts?
I agree with some of that, and I agree with the premise for sure. Of course, last year's team, which was literally the best offense in the history of college football, was led by Burrow and Brady, Joe Brady for sure. And I still give Burrow a ton of credit for it too. I think their biggest issue is actually on defense this year, because in their games this year, they've scored 34, 41, and 41. I mean, it's not bad. Their biggest issue is Bo Pelini calling the defensive plays. They had Dave Aranda last year, who's now the head coach at Baylor. Dave Aranda was the highest paid assistant in all of college football. As an assistant, he was making almost $3 million a year. That's more than Cristobal as an assistant. All right, and it does mean a lot more down there in the South, and folks, we acknowledge that. But their biggest issue this year is their defense. They couldn't stop Missouri. They gave up 45 to Missouri. That was their biggest issue. And I do think that Ed O's still a great recruiter. I just think that they need to get way better on defense. And I honestly wouldn't be surprised if this keeps up, if we see like a mid-season Bo Pelini firing and Ed O just starts being the DC. Because their defense... And I know they lost a lot of players, but their defense has been atrocious.
I think there's a list of like 5 to 10 things that we've said on this podcast that you can probably conjure up at the top of your head to describe the phrase, it just means more. And one of them for sure is Dave Aranda making almost $3 million as a defensive coordinator at LSU. That's probably like number 5 on my list of like, all right, describe the South. What exactly means more? I'd probably pull out a list and say, all right, number 5, LSU assistant coach making almost $3 million a year.
Yeah. Dude, how about OBJ handing out wads of hundreds to players just like on the field after the national title game? That was about as SEC as it gets. And it sucks because LSU apparently self-reported that today and banned him for 2 years. It's just the NCAA is just a bummer, man. But that was another it just means more moment, is OBJ just handing out wads of cash.
Bourbon Street's got to be like number 2 or 3.
Can you imagine if Oregon? Yeah, but no, Bourbon Street's epic. Really glad we got to experience that. Can you imagine if like Dennis Dixon came back and just started handing out wads of cash to Oregon players on the field? Like that just wouldn't even look right in the Pac-12. And the SEC, it almost kind of looked right, didn't it?
Did look right, man. I mean, look, we talk about this all the time. It just means more down there, and it is college football. Like I said, folks, you thought, did you even think for 1 second, a split second, a millisecond, that the college football season was going to be canceled in the SEC? Hell no. Those boys were always going to play football. You thought that Saban wasn't going to show up week one, day one, 6 a.m. with a whistle and a bucket hat, yelling at those poor unpaid players while he's making millions? Come on now. There's always going to be SEC football, even in the middle of a damn nuclear war.
Speaking of that, of Bama and the SEC, we got Tua time in Miami. I watched the end of that Dolphins game. They brought Tua in their last game out against the sorry Jets. He handed it off a couple times and threw a pass or two. But all of a sudden, despite the fact that Ryan Fitzpatrick has had a really good year, he's like top five, top six in a ton of different passing categories, touchdowns, yards, etc. They just benched him, even though the Dolphins are 3-3 and playing pretty well. And I get that they used the number five pick on him, on Tua. I think it was number five, something like that, top five. But, man, I was surprised by this, Big Tony. Tua will become the first left-handed quarterback to start an NFL game since Kellen Moore in 2015. That nugget courtesy of Andrew Siciliano from NFL Network. Is this the right move for Tua to be starting?
I don't know. It seems so bizarre. It's not like Fitzpatrick was playing terrible or he got hurt. He was balling. He really was. He was having a good year. It was such a surprise to anyone that there's got to be something. It's got to be something that the eye doesn't see. Otherwise, this really doesn't make sense. I got a quote here from Fitzpatrick. This is someone on Twitter. His name is Armando Salguero. Ryan Fitzpatrick, quote, "I basically got fired yesterday and my day consisted of Zoom meetings with the guy who fired me and sitting in a room with the guy who replaced me for 4 hours. Okay, so looking at that, Fitzpatrick didn't approve it. It's not like Fitzpatrick went to coach and said, hey, man, it's Tua's time. He's ready. I'm ready to give the reins up to Tua. I think that he should be starting and get some exposure and some experience. So reading this and some other stuff, sounds like it was a surprise to Fitzpatrick too.
Yeah, he's the word, like, heartbroken. The Dolphins have won 3 out of their last 4 games. They're 3-3 overall. And their last 2 games, they won at the Niners 43-17 and at home against the Jets. Granted, it's the Jets, but they beat them 24-0. It just doesn't make any sense to me. They got the Rams coming up next. Let's see. Is that going to be this week? So the Dolphins actually have a bye, and then they have the Rams next week. With Tua, doesn't make any sense, man. Plus, Fitzmagic is just—he's got the great beard. He's kind of balling, and you know, typical Fitzmagic is to play better than folks think he'll play. And I don't know, until he has like a stinker of a game, I don't know why they would have, why they didn't keep going with him. All right, John Wall playing cards during an interview with Jason Fitzsimmons and Field Yates. Do you see this, Big Tony?
I did.
I thought it was kind of classic John Wall. I wasn't like a lot of, I mean, you know, these folks on Twitter, man, they overreact, obviously. I wasn't like offended by it. I just thought it was like typical John Wall. I was like, yeah, this is who this guy is. He's laid back. It's definitely fair criticism to say at times he doesn't care enough. I don't even think he was like intentionally being disrespectful. I think it was just like who he is. I think he was like, all right, man, like, yeah, whatever, I guess I'll do this interview. Like, he just doesn't, the guy just doesn't care enough. He got his bag, and he just doesn't care enough.
Yeah, I am not one to, I guess, slander these kind of moves from professional athletes on Twitter. I just think it's kind of a weird thing to reach at and say, like, how dare he? Especially totally. in 2020 when we got a lot of other problems going on in life, but that's Twitter in a nutshell, man. You know, these folks on Twitter, Twitter is, as Charles Barkley put it, you know, where idiots go to feel important. But I think more than that, it's just a place where people go to slander. That's what you're going to find on Twitter more often than not is people ripping on other people, whether it's justified. That's a whole different argument, but know the platform, you know what you're getting into.
All right, folks, my college football picks for this weekend. I have 3 picks that I feel tremendous about. I've done some
Make the deep drive.
I've done
make the drive picks.
I've done some deep research. I'm feeling like Bama minus 21 at Tennessee is a mortal lock. This might be my mortal lock of the century. Jarrett guaranteed pick six. Garantano threw back-to-back pick sixes against Kentucky last weekend at home. They benched him. Their backup came in and threw a pick. And Bama's offense is not going to be slowed down by anyone. I mean, Georgia is truly a great, great defensive team with a great, great defensive coach in Kirby Smart and great talent. And Bama hung 41 on them. What are they going to do against Tennessee? They can hang 50s easily. And Tennessee's offense is not going to keep up. They're going to score maybe 14, 20 points max. This feels like a 55-20 type game, if you ask me. Especially with Ohio State playing this weekend, I think Bama wants to make another statement. Bama minus 21 at Tennessee. A couple other games, Ohio State minus 26 against Nebraska. Like I said earlier, I think Ohio State's third stringers could beat Nebraska by 26 or so. San Diego State, UNLV, under 49. Here's some research for you guys. San Diego State's games went under 49 in all 12 regular season games last year. Every single one of them combined went under 49. Only their bowl game, a 48-11 win against Central Michigan, went over 49. You know why that is? Because they run a pro-style I-form offense where they run it 80% of the time, and they have Brady Hoagie as their head coach pulling the strings. You know who's pulling the strings at UNLV now? Of course you do. Marcus Arroyo is pulling the strings on offense. He's come out and stated that he won't name a starting quarterback until the game, and that they're running the pistol offense. Folks, that just smells like a under 30. Forget under 49. I'm feeling that one as another potential even lock. A couple other games for you guys. Michigan-Minnesota, I'm going under 54.5 on that. Michigan's going to trot out kind of a stiff quarterback. And Harbaugh's offenses in general have been kind of stiff. Plus, it's like absolutely dumping snow in Minnesota. Northwestern Maryland, under 55. Northwestern's offense is completely stiff. Maryland, don't really know anything about that program, but they've been really bad, under 55. And then my two other tempting picks. So those are my five, feel great about. Two other tempting picks. Hawaii, Fresno State, over 67. Feels like every game Hawaii plays, it's like 45-40. They got to be able to get over 67. And then Minnesota plus 3.5 at home against Michigan. Minnesota's got that Tanner Morgan guy back at quarterback. Really, really good quarterback. Unfortunately, Rashad Bateman, their receiver, I believe declared for the pros once the Big Ten decided to not play for a little while. That being said, if you ever get a good team at home getting points more than a field goal, I think it's usually a good recipe, especially against a stiff offense from Michigan and the fact that it's snowing. Minnesota plus 3.5 at home versus Michigan. Tony, those are my picks.
I love it. Really quickly, for college football, and you want to smash the over on something, look no further than the American Conference. The American Conference is full of great value Big 12 teams. They don't play any defense. It's even worse than in the Big 12. They play literally zero defense, passing league, 7-on-7 kind of defense, two-hand touch. And on offense, they run up the score. I don't care what the over is or who's playing in the American. If you can get an American line at like 65 or below, just put your mortgage on it, folks. And thank me later.
I like that. Tulane UCF, 72.5 is the over-under. And it'll probably hit.
Should be 102.5.
Yeah. Wow. Tulane football, baby.
Tulane is the worst secondary of all time. All time. The worst secondary in college football history.
Really? Okay.
They just gave up 600 yards almost to SMU.
They almost covered that.
They did, but how are you going to give up 600 yards of offense?
Yeah. No, totally. I feel that. The pick this week from the experts that I'm reading about is Cincinnati plus 2.5 at SMU. Apparently SMU's best receiver is out, and folks are feeling like SMU's a little overrated, and Cincinnati has a great defense. That's the word out there on the American this week.
I like it.
So there you go, folks. We are your betting insiders. It's probably a good thing that the Oregon Scoreboard app doesn't have the college football bets, because I'd be betting like every single game. But those are your mortal locks. I gave you three great locks, and I hope they come through for you. Thanks again to Aaron Fentress for joining us. Big Tony, thank you for coming on. And great pod, man. Great pod.
Always love it, brother. Can I just get one quick thing off my chest before we wrap up the show for the folks?
Yes.
Sports media content in 2020, folks. What is it? I keep seeing this like really watered down version of Photoshop graphics, you know, creative content, as they like to say, coming from major accounts like SportsCenter, Bleacher Report, House of Highlights, on Twitter, Instagram, whatever. And it's so bad. It's like it'll be like a SpongeBob meme slandering like a team or a player after a poor performance. And I see this and I think to myself, this is it. It may not be rock bottom, but it's close, and this is where we are. And to get here, the sacrificial lambs were hardworking journos that did feature stories, television reporters, hardworking, fact-based, objective, clever, and, you know, really smart pieces and content that took a lot of time to create. And to see the industry shift to a lot more SpongeBob memes and a lot less feature writers and hardworking reporters is really sad for someone who cares deeply about the industry and has put a lot of time in the industry, as I know you have, Chief. And it's especially sad to see, coming from accounts that I want to follow for other reasons. Like, I want to follow SportsCenter on Twitter and Instagram so I can get highlights and scores and articles and updates. I don't want to follow that account to get a SpongeBob meme, but yet it's there and there's nothing I can do about it. So it's really sad to see for a multitude of reasons. And I had to get off my chest that, like, that's not it. That's not the kind of content that we need in 2020, man. I know that this is kind of the current landscape of the industry, but to see this and to see where we are, and quite frankly, to see the forecast and the projection, it's really scary. And it's just disheartening, Chief. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that too. I mean, you know, social media is one of those wild animals where we talk about all the time, like, it doesn't really matter. Things on Twitter don't really matter, because they definitely don't. Like, in the grand scheme of life, someone's take on Twitter definitely does not matter. But at the same time, people view that stuff. People are on social media all day. And, like, social media clicks get people paid. Like, the reason Barstool is having so much success and getting hundreds of millions of dollars invested into it by, like, casino companies is because they get clicks. Like, there's no, it's not a coincidence that all of a sudden Barstool in the last, like, month or two is all obsessed with gambling. Like, 80% of the content is, like, gambling content, because Penn National just bought into them for $100-something million. So, like, what I'm getting at is, social media, while it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of life, it is huge for media companies. And while that might sound obvious, like, that's just why they're trying to put out this content, because they're really just trying to get clicks. And I mean, that's pretty much it. They're pretty much just trying to get clicks. And it has been interesting watching the evolution of ESPN, because ESPN used to be pretty, I guess, stiff would be the best way to put it, as far as adapting to the times with regards to discussions, with regards to social media, etc. Now, to their credit, they fully embrace gambling. They literally have gambling shows that air on ESPN from Las Vegas. They have lines all the time. And they're adapting. They hired that Omar guy from House of Highlights, and so they're trying to adapt with the times as far as social media goes. I can't directly speak to like every piece of content, whether it's like a SpongeBob meme or something. But I think that's why they're doing it, because a lot of like certainly some part of the valuation of that company is how many clicks they get on social media.
You're right. That is the why. And my point is that it's sad. I don't know how to fix it. There's a lot of problems in the world that people have tried many, many years to fix, and they still exist. It's just a complaint from my end. I admit it's a full-on complaint. I don't know the answer. I know why it's a problem. I know how it's happened and how it's gotten to this point. I don't know how to fix it, / I don't know if it can be fixed at this point. That's all it is. It's just a complaint from my end.
Totally. Totally fair. All right, there he is, folks. You know him. Big Tony, a.k.a. Anthony Piganelli. I'm the field, a.k.a. Preston Highfield. Thanks again to Fentress for coming on. And thanks to you guys for all your continued support. Definitely hit us up with your thoughts on this episode. I'm sure many of you will have some fun opinions and feedback on the Fentress interview and perhaps our college football takes as well. Follow us on Twitter, on Instagram, at Tony in the Field. You can find us on SoundCloud and on Apple Podcasts. You guys know where to find us. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you guys soon.